Welcome to Rocket Talk, the Tor.com podcast. I'm Justin Landon, hosting as always, and tonight I'm joined by fantasy author Peter V. Brett. Peter is the New York Times bestselling author of four novels, including The Warded Man, The Desert Spear, The Daylight War, and the just-released Skull Throne. He's also written a handful of novellas set in the Demon Cycle world. Welcome, Peter.
Hey, thanks for having me.
When I call it the Demon Cycle world, is that accurate, or do you have a much cooler world name that I'm not aware of?
No, I really don't. Like, this is one of the little things about my series where there's a matter of some debate whether or not it is set on our world in some sort of post-apocalyptic state, or set on like a separate fantasy world. And it's one of those things that I'm very careful not to address one way or the other. Like I know the answer, but I think it's more interesting to leave it unsaid for a while. So I just I haven't brought it up. It probably won't come up in the series. Like someday when I'm old, I might be Ray Bradbury and be like, it was never about censorship. It was always about the horrors of TV.
It's funny. I actually think that's one of the things that bothered me the most about Terry Brooks as I learned more. I loved the early books. And then when I learned that it was all this complicated 20 book cycle of death and rebirth of civilization, I was that makes my head hurt. Of our world, it just made my head hurt.
Yeah, to be fair, I've always been a huge Terry Brooks fan, and I would credit Terry Brooks, in fact, with cementing my love of genre reading. Like, I read Lord of the Rings, and then the next thing I read was Wish Song of Shannara. And if that book hadn't been amazing, I might not be doing this today. So I speak from a place of total respect of Terry Brooks, but I skipped those Genesis of Shannara books because I liked thinking that it was some separate world that had nothing to do with ours, and I didn't really want to see the transition. It was kind of like, do not look at the man behind the curtain stuff.
Right. For me. That's funny. Terry Brooks was my ground zero too.
During the earthquake, right? You read Sword of Shannara. Yeah,
that's true. The first fantasy series I ever read was Lloyd Alexander's Chronicles of Prydain.
Mm-hmm.
And then I just found Sword of Shannara in the library, and that was what I read next. And it was good. I enjoyed it, but it was really Elfstones that made me the real.
I 100% agree with that. Wish Song was the first one I read. I read the first trilogy backward just because I was just getting them from the library, and I was kind of I didn't know that they were a series, and so I was just, this looks like a book I would like. And so I read them backward, and it was Elfstones, that's certainly the best of that three. And that book freaking blew me away. And you can see echoes of it in the Demon Cycle.
It's being made into a TV series by MTV, right?
And I'm so excited about it. I hope to God it's good, because I would love to geek out on some Elfstones again.
If you look at the fantasy television show spectrum, you've got the Sword of Truth on one end, and you've got Game of Thrones on the other end. And so if it could fall, even just in the middle somewhere, I think I'd probably be pretty happy.
Well, but to be fair, Sword of Truth happened, 15 years ago now? 10 years ago? A while ago. TV in general, and genre-based TV specifically, has gotten a lot better since then. Mm-hmm. There are so many good genre shows now that I feel like the landscape has changed, and you probably couldn't get away with what Sword of Truth was like. If you pitched if you pitched the first episode of Sword of Truth as a pilot now, they'd be like, oh, we could do better than that.
Yeah, it's probably fair to compare it more to Hercules, The Legendary Journey, than Game of Thrones.
That comparison, it holds up a little better.
Yeah, right. No, I must have watched, I think of all the television I've watched in my life, I've probably watched more episodes of Hercules, The Legendary Journeys, and Highlander.
See, I was a Xena guy. I like Xena, and I would watch Hercules every once in a while, if I was bored. But Xena was the one I followed. It's weird.
Yeah, no, I enjoyed Xena as well. I have to admit, I had a super crush on Callisto.
Yeah, I could see that. Yeah, Hudson Leak.
Yeah, yeah, she was the bad one. I guess that's just how it goes. So
that's how you roll.
Yeah. So so last time you and I were together, we were in Detroit, and it's funny because I was getting ready to for the show tonight, I was thinking to myself, I said, surely I've had Peter on Rocket Talk. It's been, over a year since the podcast started. Surely I've had him on.
Yeah. Always a bridesmaid, never a bride.
Yeah, right. But I think it's because you and I have talked several times since, and so I was going through like all the things we've talked about over the years at conventions, and I was running through my head. Anyway, last time we were together, you commented and kind of gave me a hard time about my nerdware. I was wearing my geek T-shirt with the blazer over it.
You had the Green Lantern shirt too.
I did.
There were three other Green Lanterns at that con, and I have that same shirt. And I remarked to Lauren, I was like, "Good thing I didn't bring my Green Lantern shirt." And she's like, "God damn right, they're everywhere."
That's so true. I hate it. I hate it when I see another nerd like me.
Yeah, but Saladin Ahmed was wearing one too.
Yeah, and I'm sure he was super pissed. You know, he's like, "I'm the published author. Y'all should take yours off."
No, I just like I was giving Mike a hard time about this because like he went out and bought a blazer for the specific purpose of wearing the T-shirt and blazer to nerd events, and I was like, "Oh, dude, that's so last season." You know, that's what we went to this party at Worldcon. It was like the Voyager book 20-year anniversary party in the Gherkin. And at that event, every man there was wearing a nerdy T-shirt and a blazer. And I was like, I don't want to do this anymore if it's this mainstream. So I've been trying to find an alternative that is both, you know, like presents me as a classy, like intelligent person, but also like short, you know, lets my nerd show. And I have yet to find the replacement solution, but I feel like the nerdy shirt and blazer has become so mainstream that I don't want to do it anymore.
Okay, so that was actually the root of my question was if we have to retire the nerdy shirt and the blazer, like what's next? I was hoping you had a solution.
I don't know. I think on this tour, I think I'm going to stick with nerdy shirt, but I'm going to wear this like leather jacket that I got in Morocco. Oh, it's like a slate blue leather jacket, and so like it's not like your standard like Neil Gaiman black leather jacket or something. I'm going to see how that works, and I got like. I bought a pair of zippered high tops because I'm going to be in the airport every day, and I didn't want to have to like deal with taking high tops on and off at the scanner all the time. So I got a pair with like a cheat zipper on the sides.
My 18-month-old son wears those. This is
yeah,
zip up high tops, classic.
Well, I checked it with both Lauren and Gail Carriger, and both of them approved the fashion choice, and so I decided like I was just going to make life easy for myself at the airport and like. Get a pair of shoes that just zip off. Because I'm going to be in the airport once a day, every day for like 9 days or something. I don't want to.
Yeah. Definitely a better fashion choice than what I tried to get Brent Weeks to wear on his tour, which was a dog shirt.
A what shirt?
I tried to get him to wear a dog shirt with sayings from his book. I sent it to him. I sent him a dog shirt with, it said like, you know, much Luxon, so Kip, wow.
Yeah, I've seen that image, and that is a very funny image.
Yeah, he apparently refused to wear it, which
I think Sam Sykes might have made that.
Gold Thrones is when this podcast airs will be out. You've said before that each of your books, and we'll presume that many people who are listening to this are familiar with your other books, but you have said a lot of your other books have sort of their own theme. That Warded Man was a book about fear, and Desert Spear was a book about sort of exploring the other. And Daylight War was sort of an exploration of relationships and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And so what do you think is going on in Skull Throne that is kind of your thing that you're working on here?
I think Skull Throne is mostly about politics in the way those other books had their themes. And these things are these sort of overarching themes are things that like I'm sort of thinking about them as it's going along, but I also kind of like look back and realize that like there are even it even shows in ways that were not intended. And because it in part is intentional and part of it is a reflection of just like what's going on in my life at the time. And so like The Warded Man was right after September 11th. I was working on that and I was shit scared about like, you know, the state of the world. And I think everybody who had half a brain in America was feeling the same way. And particularly those of us who were living in New York and were like, you know, we're in the thick of it when it happened. The idea of immortal demons that are immune to like normal weapons. How do you deal with an enemy that you can't fight? You know, that there's nothing for me to hit because, you know, like, and so that was a clear parallel that like was a leaping off point for me. But then like, as the story built from there, that theme just found its way into a lot of things, even unintentionally, because that was just the state of mind I was in when I was writing it. And then with Desert Spear, I feel like I had gotten a little frustrated with the state of our reaction as a nation to September 11th. And I thought that we, like, you know, maybe made some bad decisions about how we dealt with the problem. And some of those decisions came from a lack of understanding of the you know, so-called enemy that we had, and like, or even like a willful ignorance of it. Where people were just happy to throw whatever they hate onto a people without really making an effort to understand them at all. And so in, you know, that was sort of my theme idea for the Desert Spear, was to take this character who seems like the villain and reintroduce him as like, as an innocent, as a child, and kind of show his life's path and in such a way that the reader is rooting for him. You know, like when he encounters a problem, the reader wants him to succeed. And so that, I think, that was my plan for that. But then again, like, the book sort of took on a life of its own. And a lot of that was influenced just by the state of, like, the news I was reading and the cultural zeitgeist at the time. And then Daylight War, like, I was like in the middle of a divorce and, you know, like starting a new relationship and dealing with all of the sort of repercussions of that, looking at my new relationship and seeing like all of these ways that it made me better as a person and, you know, ways that it was challenging. And that was something that I wanted to explore. And so that, like, and by that stage in the series, you know, when you're writing a long series like this, it kind of always devolves into a soap opera, whether you want it to or not. And, you know, whenever you're dealing with like the ongoing lives of characters and those characters are out fighting and fucking and whatever, like, that builds up a bunch of drama that doesn't just go away from book to book. And it's sort of like an increasing encumbrance on the writer to maintain all of that ongoing drama, but still keep the story fresh and new and exciting. And so by that time in the series, like, all of the characters had kind of like hooked up and were in romantic relationships. And so then that book was really sort of like, let's explore what these relationships do. And some of these relationships are going to succeed and some aren't. And every one of them is going to be totally different from every one of the others, because, you know, it's a relationship is how two people balance their crazy against each other. And that mixture is always volatile and different. So then this last book, Skull Throne, I think is about politics. Politics are something that's sort of been on my mind, you know, like frustration with domestic politics and sort of seeing how pretty much every war there's ever been, and certainly all the wars that are going on in the world right now, are more a result of domestic politics than they are of foreign politics, if you know what I mean. I don't know. You invade a country not so much because you have something against that country or even that you necessarily want that country's resources. It's usually more to, like, you know, so that you win an election at home. And so that was something that had kind of been on my mind. And at the end of Daylight War, without too much spoilers, like, the leadership of an entire nation of people is left in question. And you have a group of people, all of whom are vying for that throne, the Skull Throne, you know, the titular Skull Throne. And everybody's trying to rally to their base and get people to support them. And that results in like a bunch of international political decisions and the start of the jump start of a war that maybe shouldn't have started yet, for the sake of securing a seat on the throne. And so that's something that, like, sort of built as a theme throughout. And it's also about how other cultures, even when they need to ally with each other, can't get past their own internal politics and their own, like, personal biases to realize that they need each other's help. That was kind of the exploration in the Skull Throne. And I think, I don't know, I'm pretty happy with how it's come out. You read the book, so maybe you have a different opinion, but I'm happy about it.
No, you know, that's funny. As I read the book, and this is a great credit to you as a writer, you really can get lost in your books and you become, they're very immersive. It's difficult sometimes in an immersive book to kind of see the forest for the trees because you find yourself inside it. Where a book that's a little bit more overtly intellectually engaging, you're looking for themes more overtly. So until you even brought up the politics angle, I hadn't really thought a lot about it. in the novel, except now that you talk about it, it becomes sort of a lot more obvious. and, you know, as somebody who's worked in politics most of my life, the notion of how you have structured that loss of leadership and how all of these people are sort of, for lack of a better term, campaigning to take the seat. And political endeavors are driven by the notion that to accomplish a goal politically, you run to the fringe because that's where the base exists, right? And so you have these characters who are doing, frankly, stupid things. Because that's what they believe their core needs to see. And that if they can get their core motivated, then they're already on their way, right? You don't appeal to the masses. You appeal to that small subsection that you know will show up for you. And you pray that if you can get through that, that maybe you can convince a wider audience.
Yeah. And they always say that in the elections, you know, in the primaries, you run to your base and then, you know, like you make a dash for the center for the general election. And it used to be before the internet that you could get away with doing a lot more crazy shit, you know, during that primary season because it was all kind of behind closed doors and not being recorded. And now it's so much more difficult because, you know, like you run too far to the fringe. It's going to come back to haunt you in general in a way that like it didn't used to. So like, I think that's still like an evolving thing.
It's certainly easier to call people out on their shit now, but it hasn't really changed yet. You know, I mean, people are still, there's still that mentality of running to the base and still that mentality. And this, of course, is why, for example, certain political parties throughout the world are finding themselves, perhaps increasingly irrelevant because they do that, because they're constantly running to that small group of people to and not thinking so much about everybody else. So,
or just and also why they become sort of increasingly crazy, because the only people who can win these, you know, primary spots are people who like are so far to the base that like they're not willing to compromise at all, and that lack of willingness to compromise keeps anything from getting done. It's certainly not just here. I think it's like that anywhere. Like, you know, the struggle to get noticed leads you to do crazier and crazy things. And then it just, you end up with a governing body that does not accurately represent its people because it was, you know, gerrymandered too heavily.
One of the characters in Skull Throne does something that I think every reader will look at and say, boy, that was really dumb, bro. Like that was a really bad decision, even based on the information that you had. And you kind of get into this like, well, that would never happen, except
that history shows that shit happens all the time.
Absolutely happens. And it happens because he had a political need that he felt he needed to prove something and thus did something pretty dumb.
Yeah. I think in the history of war, there are countless examples of like a military leader who, for the purposes of domestic politics, needed a win. And they were willing to throw, you know, any amount of resources at the problem just for the win so they could, you know, march back in triumph and accomplish whatever their domestic goal was. And so it's like, I think I know who you're talking about, but certainly there's a lot of people who make bad decisions in Skull Throne.
Yeah, true story. You mentioned a minute ago that each of these books has been an exploration of what you were kind of dealing with at the time in your life. And so I think that kind of begs the question then, and it's something that I've thought about a lot as I've read your books, is when you read the first book in the series, you're dealing with a more Western society, you're dealing with something,
It's a much more mainstream book, I understand.
Yeah, and dealing with more traditional fantasy tropes that perhaps we're more familiar with.
Yeah.
In the second book, you get a lot more of the Krasians, and then in the third book, you get a lot more, and then even in the fourth book, they're still, I would say, probably more than 50% of the story is dealing with them, or right around 50%. When you conceived the book in the first book, and you wrote it, and you pitched it, and you sold it, did you anticipate that so much of the series would be dedicated to, you know, as the quote unquote the other that you explored in the second book?
Ish. So when I sold the Warded Man, which was known as the Painted Man at the time, when I sold that book, I had written about 30% of Desert Spear. So most of the like Jardir as a child stuff, I was elbow deep in that by the time I sold the first book. So I definitely knew that I was doing that. And I will freely admit this. Like there was a sense of like, the first book needs to be a really mainstream book because I need to sell it.
I need somebody to buy it. The book Writing to Sell that I've often recommended is a great tool to work on your first manuscript, which Joshua Bilmes, my agent, gave to me because it was written by Scott Meredith, who used to run the Meredith Literary Agency, where Joshua got his first job. That book kind of shows you how to make like a very mainstream, straightforward novel, you know, like here's what your protagonist should be like, here's how you should set it up. And even then, like, I didn't always agree with everything that was in that book, but like, I wrote a book that was much more sort of in line with that skeleton for the first book because I wanted it to sell. And once it sold and I had a contract for subsequent books, I was like, okay, now I can sort of do, I can try and reach a little higher than the sort of straightforward mainstream book that I started things with, in the same way that I feel George R. R. Martin reaches higher, or Joe Abercrombie, or, you know, Scott Lynch, or Robin Hobb, or, you know, like there's a lot of writers that do this. And like, I love The Warded Man, and I'm certainly not speaking ill of it at all. I'm so proud of that book. I love that book. But I didn't want to keep writing the same book over and over again. And the Scott Meredith method is basically like, yes, you should write the same book over and over again. And that's a method that's worked for, say, Terry Brooks, who, like, you know, for what, 25 years now, has been more or less writing the same story arc again and again and again. And like, we keep coming back and buying it because it's great, but I wanted to branch out a little bit. And so I definitely had plans to sort of take a hard right turn after, or a hard left turn right after The Warded Man. I did not anticipate the culture becoming so immersive that it dominated the series in the way that it has come to do. But I don't think it's a bad thing. I think it's like an amazing thing that sort of happened organically. In order for The Desert Spear to accomplish what I wanted it to accomplish, I needed to really commit to sort of creating this culture. And once I did, it took on a life of its own and has influenced the story in so many subtle ways. And I don't think that's a bad thing. I think it's a fantastic thing, and I'm super proud of how it's happened. And what you're noticing now in this series is that the Daylight War, like the real sort of definition of like why that was the title of the book, was that now that these two cultures have like sort of forcibly met and are starting to blur together, you have this Venn diagram area where The Thesans are starting to adopt Krasian battle techniques, you know, and Krasian techniques of fighting demons and stuff, because it just makes sense to do that. You know, the Krasians are super good at that. And the Krasians are starting to see the way the Thesans treat women and the way they treat, you know, their non-warrior class and whatever. And now that they have the resources, after capturing a bunch of very arable land, now that they have the resources to feed everybody and like they don't have to oppress a certain class, like they're starting to realize some of their beliefs are dated and not best for their people. And so you're seeing the cultures influence each other as the series progresses. And like, that's a mixture that I only control a portion of it. Some of it is just unforeseen consequences when I try and figure out like how things would go in a scene that involves a group of people from different cultures.
You have this incredibly lush culture of the Krasians. Thesians, the culture, you haven't explored it as much. And I guess the argument is because there really isn't one, because of the nature of how isolated they've become from one another, that the culture just isn't as rich.
Yes and no. I think that in my, like, I have a appendix for the series that I use as my, like, reference guide for, like, person, places, things, you know, money systems, timelines, calendar, you know, like whatever, like all, I keep it all in this one big sort of appendix file. It's like 200 Microsoft Word pages. It's just like, I think it's a necessary part of my like obsession in order to keep things right, you know, straight. And so every time I create a new character or a new culture or have a new idea or whatever, I put it into that file so that I can always find it there. And it's mostly organized and sort of hyperlinked, so I can jump around in it pretty quickly and find what I need when I'm writing. And so in that file, I have notes for each one of the different, like, we call them the free cities, like the sort of isolated city-states that have arisen since the return of demons. And each one is different culturally, and each one has its own monetary system and its own system of leadership. And like, I know who the leaders are and they all, I know, and I kind of have a backstory for all of them. And like, I know who they're like, you know, green worm tongues are or whatever. And like, you know, I know like some of the like more influential citizens and whatever, you know, kind of like the way you would have like a box set in D&D for like Waterdeep or some other place. Like I have sort of a plan for each one of those places. And so the you can see the difference sometimes in the accents or in, like in, for instance, in Fort Milne, the city in the mountains, women have a very strong, they have a lot of agency. They like, because keeping the population up is so important, you need to have a child in order to get like a license to do stuff. But once you have that license, you know, having proven that like, okay, I've added to the population of the city, they get all the best jobs, they get the pick of everything, you know. And so like, the Duke of the city is male, but everyone scurrying around the Duke's offices, you know, are women. Like all of the clerks and all of the like, you know, politicians and all the council members and everything are all women because this sort of special honor that's paid to mothers. And that sort of influenced the culture there. And like, I touch on it a little bit during the parts of the story that are in that city, but like, not a lot of stuff takes place in that city. And unless I have a good story reason to give out this information, I don't want to just info dump it on the reader for no reason. And it's the same thing with Angiers, where, you know, Angiers has a much more sort of, chauvinistic approach to women. And, like, even though there are women there who have a lot of power, like, it's power that's sort of in the shadows as opposed to Milne, where it's very much out in the open. And, you know, and like each of them has their own currency system. And I have like, you know, how, like you kind of learn how like the Duke of Angiers in this book came to power, and it was kind of a weird way, and it's left him politically vulnerable. And like, so I've thought out all of these sort of cultural things, but I don't always have a good story reason to include them. But Ithesian culture was also meant to sort of be like a, you know, a very easily accessible Western culture that most people in the US or the UK or Europe could sort of easily jive with.
Cultural infrastructure, a lot of it's implied, right?
Yeah.
And I think if you look at a lot of other successful epic fantasy franchises that are out there, you find that that other culture is the one that people get most attached to, sort of, you know?
Sure.
You know, if you look at like the Wheel of Time, right? The Aiel are kind of the things that they surely greatly expanded as the series went on, I think, much the way that that you did in this one. So I think that's...
Jordan was unquestionably a huge influence on me in that regard, where you have even, like, you know, I don't know, Andor and, like, Tyr had distinct cultures. You didn't always... Like, there wasn't always a good story reason to give it to you, and sometimes Robert Jordan would maybe unnecessarily create a story reason to, you know, spell it out to you when you didn't really need it. But I always was really kind of fascinated by that and by how, like, you know, just the cultures, even in the sort of Western countries in that series, were all very different from each other. And they were different from the Shanshan, and they were different from the Aiel. And like that kind of was an education to me in how much more complex you can get with a fantasy series, like if you're willing to put in the time and effort to do that. Mm-hmm. And like I've always felt that it's worth it to do that. And I think that that has had a big effect on my work.
So I asked a little bit about the Krasians and all of that, and then you just sort of followed up a little bit more information about how you've done some thinking about how the women are interacting in the Ithesian culture. And you wrote a post on your blog that got picked up by the Mary Sue, and it was about your daughter in a superhero game that didn't have any women characters in it. I'm sure, and because it certainly was true of me, that as I had a daughter, my awareness of issues evolved. Have the women in your book, have the roles that you've put them in the book changed and evolved since you started?
So, like, I have always considered myself to be a feminist. Wasn't something that I really felt like I needed to like announce or talk about or whatever. But since, you know, I was old enough to become sort of socially and politically aware, like in, you know, say like in college, I always considered myself a feminist, and I always understood that being a feminist, you know, was not some sort of like, I want women to rule the world thing, but more of a like, that means that I think that women are just as intelligent and capable and whatever as men are and should be treated as such. And so that's something that has clearly come out in my work, but I think the intention to make it so was always there. I always wanted to have these sort of strong, like have a lot of female characters, put a lot of them in positions of powers, make sure that even in the background, you didn't have like all men doing the sort of like, you know, adjusting the knobs on the control panel behind the important characters or whatever, like to make sure there were women there too. And that's something that I've always done intentionally. And even when some of my female characters have been put into sort of very difficult, you know, violent and you know, sort of awful situations, it was because I knew people who had been through those situations and what it took for them to get through it. And when you see someone go through something like that and the strength that it takes to come back from it and then to go on to do amazing things in your life, you know, and show that that's not just the entirety of who you are, I think it was this incredible, powerful thing that I went through in my personal life. And it was something that I wanted to talk about and to kind of remind people that we can't just pretend that this sort of thing doesn't happen. You know, we have to sort of look at it for a minute and realize that this really, you know, this happens all the time. Pretending it's not there doesn't make it go away. And the people that it happens to are real people who have lives, and some of them are broken by the situation and don't go on, and others go on to like do amazing things and have amazing lives. And that's something that I sort of wanted to touch on, particularly in the early books when the emotions about my own personal experiences had sort of were a little more raw. And so like throughout the series, I've always intentionally had a lot of powerful women characters and a wide variety of them. You know, I have old women who are, you know, who have a lot of agency. I have younger women. I have women who are, you know, like, and so that was intentional. But that being said, since having a daughter, I see the problem in a way that I didn't used to. I start to see, you know, like I sat down with Cassie this past weekend, and I wanted to watch a superhero movie. And I, you know, cause I like, you know, I stacked the deck a little bit. I want Cassie to like the things that I like. And so I was like, okay, you know, we can, you know, she wanted to play Uno or something. And I was like, all right, but we're going to put a movie on. So like daddy's not bored while he's playing Uno. And,
so true. I'm right there with you.
and so I was like, you know what? I'm going to put on Iron Man. I'm going to put on Iron Man 2 because it has Black Widow in it. So there's a, you know, you have a sort of ass kicking female superhero in it as well, because Cassie needs that and wants that and like doesn't tend to associate as strongly with stories that don't have like a someone for her to visualize herself as. And so I was like, that'll be a great choice. And I put on Iron Man 2, and what I discover is that there are two women in the movie. You got Pepper Potts, who, you know, intelligent, capable businesswoman, not in the movie a lot. And you have Black Widow, who like has a few awesome action scenes, but they're in the like the last 10% of the movie. And so for the rest of the movie, she's just sort of like a spy and sort of this like obsequious woman who just sort of follows Tony Stark around. But what I noticed this time around, because I was watching it with my daughter, is that there are no other women in that movie at all. Like not in the background, you know, like there's like the Tony Stark dancers who like are all like in cheerleader costumes with an Iron Man theme, you know, like who dance at the beginning of the movie. And like, there's like, you know, women falling out of their dresses that like are like at Tony Stark's party when he's like blowing stuff up with, you know, like women with like a speaking role who are actually like sort of involved in the story. Like there are none. All of the background characters, all of the major interacting characters with agency are male. And now, like now that I sort of know to look for that sort of thing, I am overwhelmed and kind of like upset at just how prevalent it is. And like where it's just like every fucking movie is a sausage fest. I'm sort of mad at myself for not really noticing it as much before. Because there's so many movies that I loved that I try and sit down and watch them with Cassie. And I'm like, wow, there's no women in this. What the fuck? And so, like, and I think that that must in some way be influencing my writing as I go, but it's not like a, you know, like it didn't change my core intent, you know, from the beginning.
Right. No, that whole feeling of like, I guess maybe I'm not as smart as I thought I was, because I would watch stuff I never saw before that I see so much now. And part of that, of course, is to a credit to all the people in our community that have reminded me to look for it, I'll say. And that's, I think, been helpful in that regard as well. So
I agree. Like, it always stings a little bit to be reminded that you don't, that maybe you're not being entirely fair to people, because then you have to doubt yourself for a moment. But it's the only way towards being a better person, and everybody could stand to be a better person.
That was heavy, so we'll get away from heavy and we'll have a little bit more fun here. So you said you don't have a name for your world. Have you kind of looked beyond the continent of the story that you're telling now? I mean, have you thought more about your world outside of this continent, and or do you find yourself itching to work on some other intellectual property that you own?
My current, like, publishing landscape right now is that I just signed a contract for 3 books. So I've always said that I would finish the Demon Cycle in 5 books. and I'm still pretty sure that I can do that. I know what I need to do to end the series. It may mean that there are some, like, sort of very peripheral threads that don't get entirely explored by the end, but I'm still pretty sure I can do it in 1 more book. And I would really like to do it in 1 more book, because, you know, you have a huge group of readers who are like, I don't read a series until it's finished, you know, and I would like those readers to buy my books. And I would like to have, like, a breaking off point so I can say, like, okay, this is done and I did it right, you know, and I have a completed thing there, and I didn't make it like a Saturday Night Live skit and, like, keep it going past the time when it was funny. And so I kind of want that closure. And so I'm really, like, it is my intention to finish it in 1 more book. I still have one additional book on my contract. So, like, I have, you know, the first contract was for 3 books. That was up through the Daylight War. Now the second contract is for 3 books, and that's Skull Throne and The Core and, you know, to be determined book X. My original plan for that book was to have it take place in Tibbetts Brook, which is where the series originally begins. And I have, like, a whole story arc there, and, like, there's a cast of characters that are already fleshed out a little bit there. The story would have Celia Barron, who's, like, a POV character in Desert Spear. She would be the main POV character in that story. There would be others, but she would be the main one. And it would be about her getting younger as they start fighting demons. Like, the feedback magic tends to, like, make people gravitate towards their physical prime. So, like, younger people start to get older, and older people start to get a little younger. And the idea behind that story was that Celia, they call her Celia Barron because she's never had any children, but the truth of the matter was that she was a lesbian, and there was a big scandal about it. And so as she starts getting younger, you know, when she's an old woman, it was less of an issue, but as she starts getting younger, like, it becomes an issue again. And I had, like, a whole story arc around that. And I still plan to write that book at some point. But now I've got this really good idea for a new series set in the same world, ongoing, that picks up, like, you know, a generation after The Core ends. So I'm writing notes on that, and I have sort of a plan for that. But again, like, I haven't pitched that to anyone and don't really have a hard plan for it, so that, you know, I could yet make another decision. So I have notes on things that happen out, you know, off the map. You know, there's, like, another continent, and I have, like, notes on, like, what their demon situation is and how they deal with it. And there's a few other, like, sort of lost cities on the continent that we're on that also have, like, that I have sort of vague notes on thing, because every culture sort of deals with the demon problem differently. And so there are certainly plenty of places to continue to explore after this storyline with these specific characters ties up. The way that this story ties up will certainly, like, have powerful repercussions that travel throughout the, you know, that would change the landscape for a subsequent series. But I think I have a pretty good plan for that. It will also take me, you know, a year or two to write this 5th book. And in that year or two, I may have yet another idea for something totally different that I think is awesome, and I'd rather go with that. I try not to think too much about what the big future projects will be, because I don't want to take focus off this series, which I want to really make sure that I get it right. I have these ideas for future things and I sort of make notes about them and then I push them aside and get back to the work of the current series.
All right. We will not hold you to any of that then, but I do think fans of Peter Brett will be excited to hear that there's plenty cooking behind the scenes as you wrap this series up or you get closer to wrapping it up at some point.
The plan, I think, is to stay in world, but not necessarily be tied down to any particular place or character or time period. And so, like, I might do a couple of standalone books, or I might just jump right into a whole new series, but I think I'm probably going to stay in world unless I have, like, an amazing idea for something else. Because I've spent the last, I don't know, 15 years of my life, like, sort of building up this world. And I think that it's a rich playground where there's still plenty of room to do interesting and creative stories with a wide variety of characters without having to start fresh somewhere else.
Yeah, there's got to be a hard decision in there for somebody to say, like, yeah, you know, I'm just gonna put all this to the side and that I've spent all this time building up. I've heard Mark Lawrence talk about that a little bit. You know, he's gonna finish his second 3-book series, and it's like, well, do I want to just get rid of all of this? But of course, he had something that happened at the end of one of his series that really fundamentally changes the world that makes it difficult to move forward. And so when I've read your books, I'm sort of like, well, if they defeat the demons, is there any magic left? I mean, this is kind of these are the questions that'll be fun for you to answer.
Yeah. I mean, look, I know the answer to that question. I've known how the series ends since the series started. And so, without giving anything away, like, I've taken that into consideration and I have a plan and I think the plan is a workable plan that will leave everybody satisfied and resolve the current series in a way that's very gratifying and satisfying, but also, like, keep options open for, like, future magical excitement.
Awesome. I appreciate you taking the time to talk to me tonight. And Skull Throne is out on March 31st.
Yes, right? March 31st in the US and April 9th in the UK. And I will be touring both places to promote. You can actually get the book on on March 27th. If you want to get the book a few days early, if you go to Emerald City Comic Con, they have special permission to sell the book early, and I will be on hand to sign it for you. And then I will be doing Seattle, Portland, San Francisco, San Diego, Houston, and then heading off to the UK and doing a lot of stops there as well.
People can find you on Twitter at PVBrett. And
at PVBrett is the Twitter. PeterVBrett.com is the website. And I have a Facebook page, but really you just type in PeterVBrett and that'll come up. Yeah, those are the best ways to get in touch with me.
All right, fantastic. Well, everybody out there, pick up The Skull Throne. It's a fantastic book. Peter gets better with each one, which I'm sure he's delighted to hear, which is the goal. So thanks so much for coming on tonight.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it. It was great to finally do this.
All right. This has been Rocket Talk.